Hi, and welcome to the latest edition of the Pazza Chats podcast. I'm Darren Philp, and I'm your host for today. And for this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Jonathan Sharp from the legal firm Baker McKenzie and John O'Hara from Origo. Hi, both.
Hi.
Hi there.
So Jonathan is a pensions lawyer at Baker McKenzie and is a member of the Pazza DC Governance Working Group. He is a partner with over 15 years experience as a pensions lawyer and has a broad practice with a mix of employer and trustee clients. And John is a programme manager at Origo and is chair of the Pazza Transfers Working Group. He has over 30 years experience in financial services, covering both platforms and solution suppliers. And today we're going to be discussing pensions transfers and the inevitable tension that has arisen between securing quicker, faster, more efficient transfers and the implementation of the new anti-scamming legislation. And over the past few months, this has obviously been a hot topic in the press, but at Pazza, we want to take a step back, consider the issues and give some guidance as to how trustees and administrators could proceed. We've also done a DC Governance Watch, which has been produced by the Pazza DC Governance Working Group, that also covers this topic in depth. So do look out for that. So without further ado, let's get started. So Jonathan, why again are we talking about transfers?
Okay, well, Darren, I think when we think about why we're talking about transfers and where we are now, it's worth just taking a moment just to think about kind of where we've been and what's happened over the past to get us to where we are now. So, you know, for starters, members have a right, or did in the past, to take a transfer. And that obviously sounds like a good thing, doesn't it? That members have a right to transfer to another pension arrangement.
It is their money after all.
So, yeah, exactly. And then this is the problem. This is where it all falls down, I guess. Trustees are looking at it and they're finding that members are transferring to arrangements that they don't think appropriate, that are scams. And obviously, you know, trustees can warn members, you know, give them the scorpion leaflets and things like that. But ultimately, trustees are in a difficult position in that if a member wanted to transfer to a particular arrangement, they had a statutory right to it and the trustees couldn't stop them. And there was a bit of like happenstance, if I can call it that, really, in the cases. There were certain cases that said, well, if a member didn't have earnings, if the member wasn't working and making money, then, you know, they didn't have a right to a transfer. But that's not really an effective system. And it's just a bit of happenstance, really, depending on whether a member's working or not, whether they might have a right to a transfer. And so that's led us to the current position, really, that we're in, which is the government's introduced legislation. And in certain circumstances, it takes away completely their right to a transfer. And we'll talk about this more in a moment, their red flags. And in certain circumstances, it'll say, well, you can transfer, but you need to take guidance from MAPS before you can do that transfer.
So yeah, this has been bubbling over for quite a while now, and it's obviously a good thing that the government has introduced anti-scamming legislation, because, you know, I think both the regulator and others in the industry have been very proactive in highlighting, you know, the damaging impact that scams can have on people's lives. But like, people can lose a lot of money and still be saddled with a huge tax bill by HMRC, which is obviously not a good thing. And there was quite a lot of uncertainty, if I remember correctly, around sort of ombudsman decisions where, you know, providers were getting called out for not, you know, issuing a statutory transfer, even when they really thought that they had evidence of scams and stuff. And I think, is that what you're referring to, Jonathan, in terms of some of the confusion in the industry that there was before we had these new regulations?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Darren. I suppose it's a little bit of, you know, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't, isn't it? That if members really pushed it, in some cases, they would have a right to transfer to an arrangement that was a scam. And sometimes it might have been the arrangements and the people running those, like putting the members up to it and saying, actually, you know, you've got a right. You know, if I want to take a transfer, I can really push for it to take it. And so it was putting trustees in a difficult position where they didn't have any kind of flexibility there. So from that perspective, you know, there's a real policy intent and rationale for the government saying, actually, trustees should be able to hold transfers in circumstances where it looks like it's a scam.
So it's obviously good that we had some welcome government legislation to try to prevent scams from taking place. But it'll be good to sort of hear from your perspective, Jonathan, why this has caused some, you know, maybe intended or even unintended consequences.
Yeah, that's right. I think, Darren, it's one of those things where it's a difference in a way between kind of theory and practice. And so it's a great idea in theory to say, well, let's stop scams. And then it's something harder in practice, you know, when you draft it. It reminds me a little bit of there was a US court case, I think in the 60s, and the judge was asked to define what pornography was. And he said, well, it's hard to define, but I know it when I see it. And it's a bit like that here. You can look at a scam and you can go, yes, that's a scam. But when you try and define it and write it down, I think that's when it becomes kind of more difficult, really. And so there's kind of two particular issues that have arisen, really, in terms of identifying what is and isn't a scam. So the first one to talk about is around overseas investments. And the second one is around incentives. So just kind of taking those each in turn. So the first one is, well, almost all schemes will have some element of overseas investments. And it might be something very, you know, standard and normal, some kind of global equity fund, something like that, that a member might be invested in, or even another member in the receiving scheme. But the way that the legislation is drafted, it really just captures all schemes that have any element of overseas investments, and that's an amber flag, and that, which means
that must be pretty much any scheme in a way.
Exactly. So I had a case the other day where a particular member themselves, it just so happened they weren't going to be investing in any overseas investments, it looked like. It looks like something very normal. But actually, when we looked at the legislation, the fact that another member in that particular scheme, you know, might be invested in overseas investments, that meant that the amber flag was still triggered. So it's incredibly wide in terms of how it operates. And it's clear from the regulator's guidance that it isn't meant to capture these particular types of funds, if I can call them, you know, bog standard, you know, funds that are invested in overseas assets. It's not trying to capture those. But actually, you know, for the trustees, their problem is that they're saying, okay, well, regulator, that might be your guidance, but we need to follow the legislation. And I suppose in a lot of things, there's an element of kind of herding instinct sometimes. And so I think the way it's gone with most trustees is that they've said, well, actually, other people, they're treating it as an amber flag. And so we'll, you know, do the same. So we find with most clients that what they're doing is they are saying, well, this is an amber flag. And actually, in some ways, they're looking at it and going, actually, it's not too hard to push members to take advice from MAPS. It's not too much of a burden. And for trustees, they're protecting themselves. And so I think for trustees, that's the direction that they're saying, that's a reasonable place to put them in. Trustees are protected. Members, there's maybe a little bit of delay or a little bit of burden, but they can get that advice and then carry on. So we can kind of deal with that, really. I think the second one really is kind of more difficult, which is around incentives. And that's harder because if you fall foul of the incentive, that's actually a red flag, which stops the transfer. And so that's quite different to this overseas investments one, the amber flag. Now, for the incentives one, the way that it's drafted, you can read the wording and see that it's meant to cover things like an offer to access your pension before minimum pension age, which you would clearly say, well, actually, you know, getting somebody being able to get their benefits before 55, that's clearly a scam. But the way that the legislation's worded, it says that it covers incentives, and then it says including, and has that as an example, and other things as an example. And so the problem is that you could have any small incentive that's offered, you know, small monetary sum, for example, a small bit of cash, then that could be interpreted as an incentive, and that triggers a red flag. So you don't have a materiality threshold to it, the red flag. It is just, is there an incentive or isn't there? And that actually stops the transfer taking place. So we can maybe talk about options for how trustees deal with it in practice a bit later on. But actually, just in terms of the two main issues. Is that overseas investment element and that incentives element and that kind of red flag trigger.
Yeah, so if I've understood correctly, so an amber flag means, you know, sending someone to the Money and Pension Service. And, you know, I'm sure it'll be interesting to sort of understand whether they've had a huge uptick in queries as a result of this. But that obviously leads to sort of delay in the processing of transfers and stuff. On the incentives point, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that the legislation was never meant to sort of stop, you know, people offering a pen, for example, to sign up to, you know, a pension scheme or something. But I think, it, you know, both of these examples show how difficult it is to, you know, translate policy into legislation. And we see that all the time in pensions, but this is a sort of real live example of that happening. So John, you've been waiting in the wings, and we've had a very clear explanation from Jonathan as to what the issues are and stuff. What are you seeing from a you know, a practical or implementation perspective?
Yeah. So although the regulations, they clearly place obligations on practitioners around red and amber flags, etc. What they don't do, as I understand it, is it actually extend to cover counterparty to counterparty communication in a transfer. So in other words, there's no obligation to share information between the receiving organisation and the ceding organisation, information that may be helpful in determining if there's an amber or red flag. And of course, when you're transferring, that can be a bit of an impediment. But from what we've experienced, notwithstanding the fact that there is no legislative obligation to share that information, the practitioners themselves are very keen to ensure that this impediment is removed. And they've worked since November 21 tremendously well to ensure that pertinent information continues to flow in transfers. So what we've seen is they've taken their responsibilities very seriously. And as they have done for a long time as a group, they've collaborated really productively here.
And that's good to hear. And I suppose, you know, part of what your system actually does is allow for that effective communication and flow of information at scale. You know, you talked about the industry collaboration, and you said that the industry works hard and stuff, which it always does. What particularly has the industry been doing to try and make things smoother, to make sure that the letter and the spirit of the regulations is being taken forward, but also, you know, avoiding, you know, bad customer experience and all of that type of stuff?
Sure. So what they've done is, in essence, they've coalesced around a common solution to providing the necessary information on every single transfer to enable a red, amber or green determination to be made. Now, of course, there are differing interpretations out there, differing attitudes to risk, and the extent to which organisations are impacted can differ, for example, because of product offerings. But they have come together tremendously well, and as I say, they've coalesced around the provision of a common set of information from acquirer to ceder.
That's good to hear. And do you think that there has been a huge uptick in the time it's taken to do transfers as a result of this? Is there any insight you can share with us on that?
There is. So one of the things that our customer group is keen to do is to be transparent as to their transfer performance, if you like. And if you do an analysis of transfer times since late 2021 until now, the transfer times themselves are actually holding up particularly well. Of course, this does add a little bit of friction to the process, and there's been, I would say, a slight increase in overall transfer times. But by and large, I think that the transfer times are holding up very well.
Thanks for that. And I think you publish quite regularly transfer times as part of your, is it called the Origo Index or something?
That's right, yeah, the Origo Transfer
Index. And that's on your website, isn't it, I think? And it often gets reported in the pensions press, lots of interest in this. So thanks for that, John. So I think, you know, we've heard a bit about how the industry is collaborating and sharing information, and we've heard about what the actual issue is. So, Jonathan, how should trustees and schemes and administrators be dealing with this issue?
Yeah, Darren, it's really kind of interesting, this, in terms of how trustees deal with it. So with the legislation as it is, we have this position where the legislation says one thing, the regulator's guidance is saying something kind of slightly different, and trustees are having to determine, well, how do we deal with this? One change that the regulator has made to its guidance is initially it said, well, if trustees are looking to make a non-statutory transfer, so that's a transfer outside of the cash equivalent transfer regime where the member's got a right to a transfer, the regulator said, if you're looking to make a discretionary transfer, you should be following the same principles and the same approach as if it was a statutory one. But actually, kind of after recognising some of the issues with the regulations, in particular this point around incentives, what the regulator has done is updated its guidance and said, actually, there might be situations where it is appropriate to make a non-statutory transfer, even if under the legislation you can't make a statutory transfer. So I suppose in a way that's a tacit admission of saying, well, you know, the regulations aren't working the way that they're intended to. So trustees, we want you to take a pragmatic approach and, you know, effectively kind of bypass them, operate around them, call it what you will, really, to try and, you know, get to a sensible outcome. And I think, like, one way of looking at it is this way. If we just kind of focus in on the, you know, incentives point, if you had a scheme that offered like a small incentive, let's imagine, you know, it's the pen example, something like that. If trustees, you know, the day before this legislation came in, they would have been, you know, happy to make a transfer to an arrangement that offered a pen, it wasn't a scam arrangement, it was a reputable provider, then there is an argument saying, well, should the trustees really be so worried and unwilling to make a transfer to that type of arrangement now? And just kind of picking up on that a bit more and thinking about some of the arguments around that, I think the argument for saying, well, actually, things are different now and we can't just do a transfer to an arrangement that offers a small incentive now. No, the argument would be, well, actually, from the trustees' perspective, the difference is that there's new legislation that wasn't there before. And so blocking a transfer. So if we do deal with discretionary transfer, then at least theoretically, there's a risk of comeback from the member because they've got an extra argument now that they didn't have before. So the member could come along and say, actually, trustees, this was a red flag under the legislation, even for something wholly unconnected with, you know, the incentive. The member, you know, regrets the transfer or has lost money after the transfer. They could say, well, actually, you know, we, you know, trustees, you shouldn't have done that transfer. I want you to put me back in the position, you know, I was in before. So there is an element of risk that wasn't there before. But I do think for trustees, there's a number of things to think about in terms of actually reasons why it might be appropriate to do a discretionary transfer in that type of situation and ways that they can mitigate it. So if trustees do want to do a discretionary transfer, the first thing that they need to do is check their pension plan rules and see if they're kind of able to make such a transfer. And then there's two particular areas that trustees can look at in order to mitigate their risk. So the first one is around discharges. So if you're doing a non-statutory transfer, you don't get the same discharge that applies to a statutory one under the legislation. But for trustees, they can get members to sign a specific discharge form agreeing to that transfer. And that could be carefully looked at by the trustees' legal advisors to make sure that it's providing the trustees a good level of protection, that a member can't come back against the trustees afterwards and say, for example, you know, well, I want to have my benefits restored back into the transferring scheme. So that's the first thing. The second thing is around communication to members. And here by that, what I mean is, if you've got a situation where it's an incentive, for example, if you communicate to the members and say, just so you know, this wouldn't be a statutory transfer because there's a small incentive offered, do you still want to transfer? And the member ticks a box and says, yes, I understand that, and agrees to the transfer, then again, you're minimizing your risk because the member's kind of clearly accepting that they understand what they're doing and that they want to transfer. And, you know, last of all, I think the other element that needs to be thought about here by you know, for trustees, about members and the risk of complaint, is I mentioned earlier, you know, the risk of comeback if a member kind of transfers and regrets it and has to be, you know, restored back to the original scheme. But equally, I think there is a risk that you have a member who might want to transfer, and let's say the trustees refuse it because of the incentives and say, well, we don't want to. You've at least got the risk of members complaining in that situation and saying, I wanted to transfer to a perfect legitimate arrangement. Trustees, you're stopping me. And it might be that actually the member would never ever succeed in that complaint and wouldn't succeed before the ombudsman. But the trustees are still dealing with a disgruntled member, and it's the time and hassle for the trustees of dealing with that complaint. So I don't think it's entirely risk-free either for the trustees to say, actually, we're not going to make a transfer. So there's risk in kind of both elements, really. So it's not kind of clear cut either way, but there's a few things for trustees to think about there.
That's really useful, Jonathan. And we'll come on to talk about clean lists and that in a minute, I'm sure. But do providers need to do sort of due diligence each time there is a transfer there? Or, you know, can they develop their own systems and processes so once they've sort of kicked the tires on a scheme once and are clear it's not a scam, they can not necessarily wave it through quicker, but maybe do less due diligence on the second and third time that the transfer is requested?
Yeah, that's a good point, that one, Darren. I think at the moment, the issue is that because of the overseas investments and the trigger of the amber flag, what it means is that the clean list, kind of as envisaged under the legislation, can't really operate at the moment effectively, or at least that's my interpretation of the legislation anyway. And so until the point where you've got a position where the overseas investments issue is resolved, then you'd be able to look more at you know, operating in the way you're suggesting, Darren, where you use a clean list in that way. But at the moment, because of this amber flag, it's difficult to use the clean list where the amber flag is being triggered on the same scheme. So I think that is the ideal, and certainly in terms of how we're advising clients, if we're advising clients on a particular case or a particular approach in terms of issues that are arising and how to deal with them, like trustees are using that when that kind of repeat situation arises. But in a way, you know, that's kind of using experience and approaches, but that's slightly different to a clean list, yeah, to what you're suggesting
there. Yeah, and I think that's right, yeah. So, John, you're obviously seeing these things being carried out and stuff. You know, what would you like to see happen from a practitioner's perspective? If you had a magic wand and you could just, you know, get this legislation to work without being tasked with obviously drafting the said legislation, what would you like to see actually happen in practice?
Well, it's really interesting to hear Jonathan's points about clean lists, and it's something that has come up on a number of occasions when we discuss it with our customers and the broader industry. I do think there's a fairly strong argument for saying that a universal clean list, clearly, you know, how it's implemented, etc., would need to be worked out. But I think there's a fair argument for saying that such a list would help in terms of, firstly, reducing industry effort. So we know that individual clean lists, which for the most part will say the same thing, are already being built and maintained across the industry by organisations. But also, secondly, by providing the necessary level of comfort to both practitioners and consumers, I think that would be very helpful. In a way, it's a little bit like the FCA register, in that, you know, it would be a feed from a government organisation, if you like. But I do think we all recognise there's a little more to it than a simple statement of fact. You know, Joe Bloggs has FRN 123456, in that it would be providing an actual warranty as to the cleanness of the arrangement. Now, it clearly wouldn't be up to Origo to judge who should be on that list, but we could definitely accommodate such an initiative in our solution.
That's a really interesting point, John, and thanks for that. You know, I think you know, when the whole pensions liberation stuff first came out, you know, there was a lot of talk around you know, should HMRC police some of this, not least because you need to be sort of tax registered and stuff. But I think a lot of that changed with you know, the change of regime, going back to A-Day, I think, when you know, there was very little due diligence that is actually done by any government department to get tax relief and to be a sort of not an authorised but a registered pension scheme. So maybe we need to put that one to HMRC at some point. Speaking of which, Jonathan, not speaking of HMRC, but you're thinking about legislative and all of that type of stuff, you know, what needs to happen to get this legislation to work? You know, if you could wave your legal wand, what would you like to see change?
Well, I think it does need a look at, and I can see how the issues that we've got have arisen, because there is that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you've got that theory and then you've got the touching it with reality and seeing what's happens. So if I pick up on the incentives one, there, I think we need to understand from the government what its policy intention is. Is the intention that any incentive in relation to pensions, it's wrong, or is it actually it's only certain types of incentives that are wrong? But I think my own view is that actually, you know, is it really intended that any incentive, you know, the small pen, you know, is wrong? Just to give you a really small example, if I walk up to the top of my stairs, I've got a bookshelf, and my wife's got, you know, 4 or 5, you know, NatWest pigs on the shelf, and you know, that's incentive to children, isn't it, around kind of bank accounts and things.
You've got to, you know, be a certain age to you know, I never banked with was it NatWest, you said? Yeah, I never banked. I think I was with a building society or something at the time, so yeah. I missed out on the pigs.
Exactly. Well, it's my wife was much better at saving than me, so I only had the baby pig in the nappies, but my wife's got like this whole series of pigs that are probably worth hundreds of pounds now. And nobody kind of worries about incentives to children around bank accounts, and it exists across all financial products. So is it really the case that the government, from a policy perspective, thinks that all incentives are wrong? So we need to understand that. My own kind of view, if I had my magic wand to draft it, would be there's certain specific incentives that the government has written into the legislation as wrong. So, for example, accessing your pension before normal retirement age. I would have those specific examples that are most nefarious. I would say, well, these, you know, let's say 4 or 5 things, those things are a red flag and they stop a transfer. And if the government isn't keen on other incentives, it could say, well, for any other incentive, that's an amber flag, and so the member has to take advice. And that might be kind of one way of unblocking it, if that's the problem. I think in relation to the overseas investments, I do see, as a lawyer kind of looking at the drafting, I look at it and think, well, actually, I wouldn't want to draft that. It's not, you know, you can't just write into legislation a dodgy investment, can you? So it is. So there is some kind of careful drafting or thought would need to go into, well, how do you actually draft that? But maybe one thing to think about is the fact that there are already kind of amber flags around, like one around high charges. There's another one around kind of that refers to unorthodox investments. And so I do think it's worth thinking about whether actually are these other amber flags that are already there, are they sufficient that they capture or, you know, deal with what the government's concerned about here? So I'm not saying definitely remove it, but I think it is worth saying, well, what is the gap in those other amber flags that we're trying to capture here? And maybe it's something quite narrow where it doesn't fall within the unorthodox and it doesn't fall within the high charges that's trying to be captured. So I think I'd probably think about it that way. The other I think just going back to my earlier point on the clean list, it should work, I think, that if you take away the amber flag issue, that then the clean list can be that can be followed kind of more clearly or adopted by schemes. So Darren is right that clean lists kind of are envisaged in the legislation at the moment. So that is a positive that the government's recognised that they are a valuable thing, and maybe that could be looked at kind of even further. Really, just going back to kind of John's reference to like an industry, clean list, is that something that could be, spelled out or, dealt with a little bit more in the regulations? But at the moment, I almost feel like that clean list and how they operate hasn't been fully tested because trustees haven't been able to really kind of use them because of the way that the legislation's working at the moment.
Thanks for that, Jonathan. No, that's really interesting. So, John, two final things to ask you. I'm going to let you have the last word. Do you have any NatWest savings pigs? And by the way, other incentives for saving into a bank account are available. This is just as a
No,
promotion. And if not, why not? No.
but I did have a Bank of Scotland one.
Right, figures, yeah, figures.
I am of that vintage.
Yeah, aren't we all, John? Aren't we all? And is there anything that you want to add to what Jonathan's just said about potential way forward?
Clearly, I mean, I'm not a pensions lawyer, so in many ways I'm ill qualified to comment on the legislative aspects, but I do think all of the points that Jonathan has raised are very interesting and clearly worthy of further exploring. And I think, again, just to build on Jonathan's points about clean lists, I think we both agree that the detail or the implementation in detail would need to be worked out, but that it is definitely something that may well be worth exploring further.
Well, I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about this as we go forward. And I've certainly heard DWP say that if the legislation isn't working, they're very welcome to feedback. And obviously they'll add it to the list of things that they need to do, which is obviously a good thing. So, well, time flies when you're having fun, especially when you're talking about transfers. Can I just say a huge thank you to John and Jonathan for joining us to discuss the anti-scams legislation impact on transfers? And do look out for their DC Governance Watch that will be published covering this issue. You can find our previous PASA Chats podcast on value for money and the PASA business plan on the PASA website. Lots of PASAs in that sentence. So do also check out those if you've got time. We hope you've enjoyed this PASA Chats podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this PASA Chats podcast. Do stay tuned for future episodes. Thank you, John. Thank you, Jonathan. Until next time, bye all.
You're welcome.
Thank you.